Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Welcome, Patina Gappa. Is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes, that's fine, yeah.
Okay. We're talking about your second book, The Book of Memory. But could you give us a bit of your background?
I was born in Zambia in the early 70s when Zimbabwe was still called Rhodesia, and my dad worked in the Copperbelt province in a town called Kitwe. So that's where I was born, and then when I was about a year or so old, we moved back to then Rhodesia. And then, of course, Rhodesia became Zimbabwe, and so I was raised in Zimbabwe, and I left only at the age of 23 to go to university in the UK and to do a PhD in Austria. So I'm a lawyer by training, and my field is international trade law, but I've always wanted to be a writer, so I became one at the advanced age of 36.
Excellent. And that was you published a book of short stories.
That's right, yes, an Elegy for Easterly, it was called. It came out in 2009.
I really loved The Book of Memory because I do actually, oddly for a New Yorker, transplanted to London, I have a lot of Zimbabwean friends.
Oh, okay.
But they're white Zimbabweans. And
okay.
Their story is the one usually hears in the news or in person because they're able to leave.
Well, I would say that the story of the white Zimbabweans, and it's not all white Zimbabweans, it's a very particular kind of story, is the story of the dispossessed white Zimbabwean farmer.
Yes.
And that was the story that gained a lot of currency in the first years of the crisis, because the crisis seemed to be one that was rooted in race. Mugabe was attacking the whites. You know, that was the narrative. But as time went on, it became pretty clear that the narrative was much broader. And now we're actually seeing that the attacks, Mugabe is basically at war with his own country, whether the people are white, whether the people are black, whether the people are people within his own party who don't want him to run again. So it's becoming clear now that the initial story of the dispossessed white farmer is a much larger story. And I think that the world is quickly waking up to the multiplicity of other voices as well.
Yes, and that this was stories both exported, exploited, etc. Which struck me similarly to the recent story of Cecil, the lion, the Zimbabwean lion, and how that's evolving sort of as a post Mugabe Zimbabwean story in terms of the authorities backing down because in international sanctions, etc., this is one of the ways that we make money. But again, those are official stories, either, you know, exported, exploited, reported, distorted. I don't know, and I can't know.
I think that the story of Sicily is really basically the story of corruption. I'm not saying that the dentist, the American dentist who shot him, should be completely absolved of all blame. But if you are presented with what looks to you like a proper hunting permit, and somebody tells you that they've gone through all the hoops and they've got permission for you to go on this particular hunt, I think hunting is cruel. I think hunting is absolutely cruel. But hunting is allowed in Zimbabwe, and you are allowed to hunt if you have a permit and so on. So if you're presented with documents that look like they might be the real thing, and you pay for them, and you're told that this is the appropriate fee, then you don't always look beyond the obvious. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
So for me, the Cecil story is not just about this poor lion that was hunted in the most cruel manner. It's also an organized hunt who knew that Cecil was a protected lion. They knew that he was a colored lion, and they still went ahead and organized the hunt. And I think that's really where my anger is directed.
Yeah.
So for me, the story of Cecil the lion is a story of corruption in Zimbabwe.
As well as, I think, and that is very clear, But also, I think there has to be some role of sanctions and international sanctions backfiring in terms of, well, if you don't have legitimate ways of going. I mean, these are, so it's legal. And why is hunting legal? Because it is a legitimate way to make money from international sources when, either through corruption or sanctions, you don't have other means. I think all of these things.
Because, you know, tourism is more or less dead in Zimbabwe. I mean, we have domestic tourism, and we're trying to encourage tourism from China and from other parts of Asia. But the tourists who brought real money in the past to Zimbabwe were tourists from the West, and they're not coming to Zimbabwe anymore. So anything that gets them in will be something that the government will be very keen to protect. So I also think that the fact that they're not pursuing this American in any way is also largely about, as you say, trying to attract that necessary investment as a way of countering sanctions.
RadioGorgeous.com.
And that's the broader picture. Mm-hmm. And how I wanted to relate that was that in the Book of Memory, and it has been said, I have not read an Elegy for Easterly, but in that it is said that every layer of Zimbabwean society is heard in a way that we don't get to necessarily see all those different layers. And I think that can be said as well of the Book of Memory. Could you introduce us to the Book of Memory?
Oh, thank you so much. I was smiling when you were saying that, because actually I always fear that the book I'm writing will be the last book I ever write. So I try to get in it as much as possible. And I'm just very attracted to large canvases. I like to paint on a large canvas. The Book of Memory is basically a book set in a prison. It's set in Chikrubi Maximum Prison, which is the largest women's prison in Zimbabwe. And at any one time, Chikrubi Maximum holds up to about 400 women. And in that prison is death row, because Zimbabwe still has the death penalty. So it's the story of one woman who's on death row. She's the only woman on death row. She's awaiting her fate, which is to die by hanging. And as part of her legal appeals, her lawyer says to her, write the story of how you came to be here. Write the story of your life. So that's what the Book of Memory is the book of this woman's life. She's narrating her life. Her name is Memory. So it's also the story of a person actually called Memory, and it's also the story of the past, the Book of Memory.
And in it are brought to life one of my favorite themes. I'm about to see the Oresti at the Globe, is the Furies.
Mm.
And an idea that we are dealing with throughout the world, that Zimbabwe struggles with, that, you know, if you think of troubles in Ireland, the Middle East, it is these ancient conflicts that continue on through generations, and each culture seems to have them. They seem to be intractable, and how they pass through us personally as well as nationally, is one of the themes that you've written about.
It's so interesting that you mention the Arenas, you know, the Furies. That's so striking. I think I'm getting goosebumps here, because I think you're the first person to pick up on that. This book was very strongly influenced by my love of Greek mythology. I mean, there's the notion of the Chimera keeps coming up. And also, because it's largely also a book about fate, can you control fate? And I don't want to reveal the ending too much, but most of what happens to this character, Memory, in her life, most of the things that she thinks have happened to her have actually happened because her parents are trying to escape what they consider to be a horrible fate. And I only name the mother in the book once, and I call her Moira, a very common Zimbabwean name, which is also the Moire, you know, the fate.
Yes.
So it was very conscious, but I didn't want to do too much of it, because I didn't want, you know, I don't like to be too obvious in what I'm trying to do. But I'm actually getting so excited by the fact that you mentioned the Furies that I've forgotten actually what they're
called. it is exactly our efforts to escape our fate, or her parents' efforts to escape their fates that seem to continue it.
Exactly. That's exactly it. You're trying to escape your fate, but then you end up in this loop. It's like Oedipus, isn't it? Poor thing.
Yes.
He thought, he had escaped everything. You know, he was given away as a baby and everything else. And the parents thought, okay, that's it. He's gone now. And then he's raised by this shepherd. And then he comes back and he accidentally kills his father without knowing that it's his father. And he marries his mother without knowing that it's his mother. And you sort of wonder, if they had just raised him, Jocasta and what's-his-face, if they had raised him, would the same thing have happened? Or by actually trying to evade that fate, did they actually cause it to happen? Do you see?
Yes.
So I'm endlessly fascinated by those questions. And Zimbabwe is a very fatalistic society. We had an old religion before Christianity came, and it was a religion that was very much rooted in the present, right? And you had to make sure in the present you didn't do anything that offended the ancestors or that offended the community at large, because what your crimes against other people could actually come back and haunt, not necessarily you, but haunt your descendants into the future, you know?
Yes. And that was one of the voices that I was thinking about, that where the everydayness of those beliefs and the everyday application of those beliefs is not a voice I had heard before, because it's not, as I said, a white Zimbabwean experience. So that was an introduction and just a beautifully evocative window into that. And also with lives so tied to fate, and as memory says, we were poor, but we didn't know how poor we were.
But
that almost every single one of these children in, the townships that she grows up in, that they're all named with hope.
Yes.
And the parents are then named for their children's hope, with their children's names.
It's so lovely you put it that way. It's so interesting that, parents name their children, and then the children then name their parents. My Wizi, my Blessing. I'm called my Kushi in Zimbabwe because my son is called Kushinga, and it's a name that means to be strong. So he has given me the name I gave him. It's a really lovely concept, and names are so important in Zimbabwean culture because, as I said, it's a very fatalistic society. So your name is usually a name that is connected with circumstances in some way. You are named after a family member. You are named in aspirational terms, you actually have people called doctor. You have people called genius. You have people called reward, and you're named as well as a lament to fate, If your mother is grieving at the time that she gives birth to you, or there's a lot of trouble in her family, she'll give you a name that expresses her dissatisfaction and unhappiness with life. So a Zimbabwean name, which is why our names look very odd to outsiders, like somebody called Progress or whatever, but they have a beauty to them in that they are tied very much to the fate of your parents and the family at the time that you were born.
And also the aspirations to change that fate.
Absolutely, the aspirations to change fate.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women.
Can we talk more specifically about the book? Because one thing I didn't know, which I very much enjoyed, I guess my imagined pronunciation of the Shona that you include, was that's another very palpable experience of life. If life happens in different languages, if political life happens in a different language than prison life or educational life, that's a very... language is a very strong thing, like names. And how is that experienced?
You know, I say that the national condition of being a Zimbabwean is to be somehow schizophrenic in terms of how we approach language. It is so strange. You go into parliament, and the parliament uses English. They're trying now to use Shona and Ndebele and other languages, but English is the language. Is the language of the country. You know, it's the language of the newspapers. It's the language of education, right? But the minute you go out into the street, outside the formal setting, the language changes completely. And you will find a lot of English, but you also find a lot of slang. And the slang will be very specific depending on whether you're in Bulawayo or you're in Harare or you're in, you know, in the rural areas. And you also find, and then you move again from the streets, you're in a more formal family setting, say at a funeral or at a wedding. Or you're part of a deputation to marry, to bring a new daughter-in-law into the family. And there the language becomes really deep Shona. You know, because the Shona that we use for formal occasions is very different from the Shona that we use from when we're out on the street or... So we have a lot of, what are called registers of speech. We talk at different registers.
Mm-hmm.
And the register you use changes depending on the setting you're in. So you can go to work in the morning, you're using English, you go out and then you meet a friend and you're talking in slang, and then you get a phone call to say that there's a death in the family and you immediately change, you know, the way you speak. It's extraordinary. And I'm not sure that it's particularly unique to Zimbabwe, but certainly I think it's maybe a feature that is shared by any country that had a language imposed on it. I think the Irish probably have a similar thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
that the way you use English depends on the formal setting in which you are.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's like some languages have honorifics, and that those change with whom you're speaking.
Absolutely, and Shona is like that, you know. Even in the context of the family, there are two different kinds of you. There's Iwe and there's Imi. Iwe is more informal and it's more equal. It's what I would say to an equal, right? Imi is what I would say to a superior, including my parents, you know, mm-hmm. who are considered, you know, they're people that I should honor and respect. So I can't call them you in the familiar way that I would say to a friend. But it's kind of an odd thing as well, because your family is where you're most intimate. But at the same time, you can't call your parents by the informal Iwe. So it creates a very specific, I think, kind of relationship with your parents, you know. So you're familiar, there's a lot of love and all the rest of it, but there's also that respect that always has to be there.
Mm. Mm. And memory herself is in a unique position in her life. And there's not a lot of intimacy for her.
She's isolated.
Yes.
You know, she's I didn't go to Chikurubi prison to do any research because I would have had to sign the Official Secrets Act if I had done that. And of course, it would have meant I couldn't write about the prison. So the Chikurubi of the book is largely from research and also just from my own imagination. But one thing I realized is that you probably couldn't really have death row in Zimbabwe. You really couldn't. Because we are naturally a gregarious society. So this idea of isolating one prisoner from the rest of the prison, one, it seemed to me very, it would be extremely inefficient, and it seems just somehow, it would just be very, very un-Zimbabwean. So I sort of made her part of the prison. I mean, so she moves in and out, with the others. You know, she's treated as any other prisoner. And sometimes she forgets that she has this thing hanging over her, and then she reminds herself, oh, by the way, I'm actually meant to be a death row prisoner. So it's kind of an isolating thing that happens within herself, and it's not that she is physically isolated from the other prisoners.
And yet it seems to me that she has more camaraderie and she fits in better in prison than she ever has in life.
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a moment in the novel where she sort of feels like she's found the place she's meant to be in, and because she's always been isolated and she's always been different. And at this point, maybe we should mention this very nice lady.
Yes.
That memory is actually meant to be, she's an albino woman. She's a woman who suffers the condition called albinism, where you don't have melanin in your skin. And so she's a black person in Zimbabwe, but she doesn't actually look like a black person in Zimbabwe. At the same time, she looks like she could be a white person, but she actually isn't a white person. You know, so she's always had this gaze on her constantly. So she's actually used to being different and to being isolated, and that's sort of become
an exposed of her life. Yeah, there's an exposed quality to her.
Absolutely, exposed. That's a very good word. I'll use that in future interviews.
But you heard it here first.
Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you.
I have to say, it's a wonderful read because, you know, you're getting a whole cultural picture. You're getting beautiful language, and, you know, it's transportative in that way with the backdrop of Rhodesia, the and its bloody turn into Zimbabwe. And as well as, you know, this, a very personal story and a murder mystery at the same time, as well as a family mystery and secrets.
Yeah.
So it's got everything.
Do you know where it comes from? Do you know, one of my biggest influences when I was writing this novel was Barbara Vine, actually. Do you know Barbara Vine? She's the alter ego of Ruth Rendell.
Okay.
So in the Barbara Vine voice, she wrote these psychological dramas about the past.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one particular book I read that I've never forgotten. It's called A Dark Adapted Eye. And it's about a relationship between two sisters that takes a very, very strange turn. And it's such a, it's one of those slow burning, slow reveal kind of novels. And I just absolutely loved it. And so I just wanted to write something in which the past was always present. You know, the past in the Book of Memory is always present. It's never something that you think, it's been dealt with, it's over. It's always there.
And it's always there. There's something, there's another twist to it, another facet to it. It's like a vibrant living thing.
Yeah, the twists and the turns. I just love, you know, that feeling you had, and I know you definitely had it because you've now become a journalist who likes to talk about books. You know, when you're a child and you're an avid reader,
mm-hmm.
when you start a new book and you've got this tingling excitement that you're entering into this world, and then you enter it and you just don't want to leave it.
Yes.
And your mother calls you because she wants you to do a chore, and you just think, oh God, you know, I don't want to do this.
I have to rush back to my friends,
exactly.
To my new life.
Your book under your desk because you don't want to let it go and you get into trouble for not doing your homework. that feeling of being gripped by a story, you know, that's the kind of quality that I'm looking for in my work. And I really hope that I've managed to pull it off. I've had the loveliest emails from people telling me that they read it through in one sitting.
Yes. And how is it for you to write? Are you in that same grip? Or are you more removed?
Do you know, the Book of Memory was a very hard book to write. It took me 6 years to write for many, many complicated reasons. But now that I've written it, and now that I actually know I can write a novel and not just short stories, I'm kind of in a bit of a grip at the moment. I'm writing two things at the same time. I'm writing a novel, and I'm also doing another collection of short stories at the same time. So I'm in this fever of wanting to just let it all out. You know, I'm very, very superstitious. You know, I always have this thing that, oh, maybe this thing I'm working on is the very last thing I'll ever write. So I want to give it everything I have. So it wasn't always easy, you know, writing the Book of Memory. But the books I'm writing now, I'm just finding the joy of writing again.
So memory has given you confidence.
She has, absolutely. Oh no! Did I just say she has? Because I don't want to be, you know those writers who talk like their characters externally, like, oh, she came to me in a dream, she came to me fully formed. No. Memory is a fictional creature. But writing the Book of Memory definitely has given me confidence.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Bettina, thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time, and I really appreciate it.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox, who can think of anything better, darling?
Says that love is blind. Still we're offered to seek and ye shall find. So I'm going to seek a certain land I've had in mind. Looking but he's the big affair I cannot forget. Only man I ever think of with regret. I'd like to add his initial to my monogram. Somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who watch over me. I'm a little lamb who's lost in the wood, and I know I could always be good to.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.